You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Since the approval of Viagra in the late 1990s, the pharmaceutical industry have been wanting to create an equivalent drug for women. A cream, a pill, a patch, a nasal spray, anything that will help women have better sex and more orgasms. The documentary Orgasm Inc., The Strange Science of Female Pleasure, details this fevered race for a female Viagra. Along the way, it explores the role of Big Pharma in reshaping our understanding of sex and sexuality. The film is playing this week at the Pacific Cinematheque. Liz Kanner is the award-winning director of Orgasm Inc., and I caught up with her a few weeks ago when she was in town for a conference on the medicalization of sex. Now, before making the movie, you spent many years, I understand, making documentaries on topics like housing and homelessness and human rights. How did you end up making a film about the pharmaceutical industry and female sexuality?
It was actually sort of an accident. I hadn't intended to make an expose on the pharmaceutical industry when I started out making what was then called The Strange Science of Female Pleasure. I was actually burnt out after making documentaries for about a decade on human rights issues, as you mentioned, on things like police brutality, and I was starting to get nightmares from my footage. And I was also starting to get very depressed about the state of humanity. So I thought, my next film has to be on something uplifting. I want to have pleasurable dreams. So I started researching what medicine and science had said about women and sexuality, sexual response, conception, over the past 2,000 years. And I was in the middle of shooting this experimental documentary when, out of the blue, I was offered a job at a pharmaceutical company that was developing an orgasm cream for women. And they wanted me to put together erotic videos and intercut it with asexual video so they could check and see if their orgasm cream was working in these clinical trials that would take place in a doctor's office.
What was the name of that company?
So the company's name was Vivus, and when I took the job, I asked them if I could film the experience and interview them and that kind of thing, and they were okay with that. So the documentary really starts out with the sort of this story, and I asked my employers very typical kind of questions that you would ask, things like, how did you start developing this drug, and is there something really organically, physiologically wrong with these women? And the answers that I got were very curious. And so that's really what sent me on this 9-year odyssey of trying to find out, do 43% of women really have female sexual dysfunction, and is it an actual disorder for most women?
So what kind of answers did you get then from the company?
Oh, they didn't want to answer a lot of my questions. It was sort of like, well, is there anything physiologically wrong with these women? The founder of the company said, well, we don't really know. I mean, these sorts of questions, because what had happened was, in the late 90s, Viagra was a blockbuster drug for Pfizer. And the pharmaceutical industry, including Pfizer and the drug company that I worked for that also had a drug for erectile dysfunction, wanted to test these drugs on women because they thought there would be a bigger market for them there than there was for men. And so the problem was, in order to test the drugs, they needed to have a disorder. And the disorder that they came up with, female sexual dysfunction, is extremely broad. And to the point where almost any sexual complaint you have basically falls under the category of the disorder. And so what you see in my film is sort of the creation of this disease, because I followed the story for so long, and the race to develop something to supposedly cure it.
So how is it actually defined then by the medical community?
So the medical community, and I should say that the definition of female sexual dysfunction was created by 19 doctors. 18 of them had ties to 22 drug companies. The 19th was an FDA official. And the basic definition is if you have pain during intercourse, arousal problems, problems with desire, if you have difficulty having an orgasm, these are the sort of things that fall under female sexual dysfunction. But the reality is that the majority of women's sexual problems are actually caused by things like past sexual abuse, stress due to overwork, difficulties in relationship, sex education problems. I always say chore play leads to better foreplay. You know, having really equitable relationships makes a difference in terms of how women feel about their partner. So I think that there's a lot of different reasons, and there's a small percentage of women that do actually suffer from medical conditions where one of the symptoms is a sexual problem. So if you have diabetes, you can have trouble having orgasms because of blood flow issues. If you've had a hysterectomy, that can change your hormone levels, which can affect libido, but not for all women. And this is not for all women that have diabetes either. And if you are taking antidepressants, some SSRIs can affect women's sexual function. So there are a small percentage of women that really do suffer from medically induced problems.
How do you think the emphasis on medical explanations for sexual difficulties shapes then women's experience and understanding of sex?
Well, I think that's what was so surprising to me in my documentary. To the extreme that women would go to try and have what they considered a normal sex life. And I think this is the danger, that if the pharmaceutical industry can make women believe, and the medical industry in general, that they should be having a fabulous orgasm every time they have intercourse, if they can make women believe that they're supposed to be having a certain number of sexual thoughts a week to be healthy, if they can make women believe that they're supposed to get aroused in a certain way, then you can basically make every woman think that there's something wrong with her, because our sexual experience changes depending on our day, depending on our mood, depending on where we are in our menstrual cycle. So there's so many periods where it waxes and wanes. And so if we can make people believe they're supposed to be living up to this certain standard of sexuality and sexual performance, you have a huge market there. But the reality is that you know, I think that there are things that women can do to enhance their sexual experience that don't require medical intervention. And because we're not a very well-educated world at this point around sexuality, in my film, I discovered a lot of women don't know where their clitoris is because we don't teach this in sex education classes. And in fact, I was just cutting the DVD extras for Orgasm Inc., and I was editing Dr. Susan Bennett, a doctor at Harvard Medical School, giving a tour of the clitoris. And I kept having to re-listen to the footage because the clitoris is huge, and trying to explain, it's very complicated. It goes in all different directions. It basically, nerve endings are these glands that come down that run up the urethra about 5 inches, and then their nerve endings go deep into the pelvis. So the actual part that you see of the clitoris is just the glands of the clitoris. It's like the glands of the penis. It's just the tip. It goes all over the place and all deep in our body. So, you know, we don't teach this in sex education. We don't teach that the most sensitive part is not actually the vaginal canal, but around the cervix. And actually, some of the most sensitive parts for women is above the clitoris, and not actually the clitoris itself for a lot of women. There's all these sorts of things that we don't teach. We don't teach the full sexual response, that 70% of women need direct clitoral stimulation in order to have an orgasm. I'm going to repeat that. 70% of women need direct clitoral stimulation in order to have an orgasm. And that's with penetrative intercourse as well. So we have this idea that when we have penetrative intercourse, that we're supposed to be having fabulous orgasms, and a lot of women find they don't. Well, that's totally natural. But often introducing a vibrator or clitoral stimulation manually can have a big effect for a lot of women.
Now, you have the story of a woman in the movie Charlotte. Tell me about Charlotte.
Yeah, so Charlotta is a perfect example of what we're talking about. She was in her early 60s when I interviewed her. She was a therapist, very educated, and she decided to take part in the clinical trial of an orgasmatron, which I always think orgasmatron, you know, think Woody Allen, Sleeper, and that kind of thing. And this orgasmatron was actually an electrode. It was not harmless, that you stick into your spine, sort of like an epidural. It's a whole surgical procedure. And she decided to partake in the study because she was not having the sexual experience she thought she was supposed to be having. And so she went through this harrowing surgery. It was actually, filming the orgasmatron surgery was very difficult for me because it was so intense. It went on longer than it was supposed to. It was bloody. And I just was thinking, wow, you know, this could really harm. Basically, the side effects are things like paralysis, potentially. I mean, it was very risky. And when she came out of it and she did test it, all that it did was make her leg jerk up and down. I hate to give away the movie. I don't want to give away too much. But basically, it just caused her leg to, and she's had this very funny line, "I'm only good if you like to be kicked in the behind." But when I said to her, "Charlotta, you know, can you have orgasms through other means besides just penetrative intercourse with your husband? It turned out she could. And she did not know that 70% of women need direct clitoral stimulation in order to have an orgasm. And so when I told her this, she literally got up and started dancing around because she realized she was normal. So I think this just speaks to the fact that on some level, in our society, we are over-sexualized. Children start looking at pornography on the age of 11 on average now. And on the other hand, we're completely undereducated. So our expectation of what our sexual experience is supposed to be like is really inflated. And yet we don't have the basic knowledge to even get there.
How do issues of race and sexuality and class play into the construction of female sexual dysfunction?
You know, I think in some ways, one could say that this harks back to the age of the Victorian era with hysteria, that this is, which was an upper middle class white disorder. But I would also say, I think there is some elements of that. It's certainly very, very heterosexual. It's very heteronormative. I would also say, though, what we see as a difference here is that the medical industry really doesn't care what race, class, or gender you are. If they can sell you a product, if they can get your insurance company to pay for it, if they can get you to buy into this model, they want you as their consumer. They don't see you as a patient. They see you as a consumer. And so I think that they're going to try and make their market as large as possible. I mean, we saw this with Viagra. It was only tested on older men, but the marketing for it was at younger and younger men. So basically, they want everyone on their drugs because they just make more money.
Now, in addition to making this documentary, you're also involved in advocacy work around the issue. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, I've been doing a lot of speaking and screenings of the film all over the world now, really trying to educate the public about this issue because I have deep concern that we're really very much at risk of seeing a real shift in our understanding of what sexuality is supposed to be like. And we could think, oh, this is sex. It's not that important. But actually, sex is extremely important. And it's the period when we feel the most vulnerable, where we feel the most intimate. And it's a way that you can control people. If you can get them at that moment to think about your drug or your disorder or, you know, your religious belief or whatever it is, that's a lot of social control. And so I think that we really need to get the word out about this. I also have deep concern because when you look at the sort of sales of Viagra and you start to think if we had those sorts of sales for women, a lot of the drugs that they're working on developing for women are not like Viagra where the men maintain control. They can take the pill when they want to. When they want to have an erection, you just take it at that time. They're developing drugs for women where they have to take them every single day. And that gives you less control over your experience. And it also means that you can have really serious long-term effects. We've seen that with HRT, hormone replacement therapy, and other drugs that have been given to women where they take it every day. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of concerns because with something like this, you're talking about millions and millions and millions of people. So that's why I'm so concerned about it.
Now, what do you see as the most effective and meaningful ways to challenge the scientific authority and knowledge of the medical industry?
I think that's such a good question because when we see someone in a white lab coat, there's so many ways that we've been taught to think of them as experts. And the research I've done, I've discovered that a lot of these medical experts are really salespeople. And they get a lot of monetary benefit from trying to get you on their drug, trying to get you on certain drugs, that they actually get vacations. There's all different ways that doctors are reimbursed for this sort of prescribing of specific drugs by the pharmaceutical industry. In addition, a lot of the medical experts I've discovered, at least in the United States, that we see on television are working for the drug industry. They don't disclose this. There's no laws in the United States, at least I don't know about Canada, that says that they need to reveal any sort of financial ties they have to the pharmaceutical industry. So I think that as a public, we really need to try and stay as vigilant as we can and keep ourselves informed about these things. There's a wonderful website, Our Bodies Ourselves, that people can go to that's a resource that really talks about sexuality. It will answer any of your questions. It was developed 40 years ago by feminists, and they keep updating it. There's the New View campaign that Leonore Tiefer is running, and the New View campaign has a website, and they are fighting the pharmaceutical industry around this issue, so you can see what sort of the latest thinking is about this. And just be very careful in terms of making sure if you get on anything like testosterone, a lot of women have been prescribed testosterone, but in the clinical trials and the FDA hearing for a patch in the United States, A few years ago, it was not approved because the actual efficacy above placebo was tiny, and the health risks with testosterone include things like breast cancer. So I would say before you get on any medical drug, make sure that you've done everything else possible to have a better sexual experience.
Now, you started on this path of making this movie in order to improve the kind of dreams you have. Did it work?
Unfortunately, I'm still having some nightmares. It's not easy to go up against the pharmaceutical industry. As I said, I didn't mean to make an expose, but I'm hoping my next film will be about pleasure.
And I spoke with director Liz Kanner at the end of April. Her film, Orgasm Inc., is showing this coming week from June 2nd to June 4th at the Pacific Cinematheque, and that's 1131 Howe Street in Vancouver.